In the mid to late 1970s, the emergence of home video rentals impacted the film industry in a number of ways, including the opening up of new markets for distribution, which helped to create opportunities for smaller independent companies, as well as having an aesthetic impact, in that the availability of movies in the home would go on to influence emerging and future filmmakers. My guest today is Dr. Johnny Walker. Johnny has written extensively on horror and exploitation film, and is the author of Contemporary British Horror Cinema, Industry, Genre and Society, published by Edinburgh University Press, and is currently authoring a new book on the history of video rental culture in Britain in the 1970s and 1980s, called Britain and the Video Boom. And this episode of Newton Talks is all about this subject. This discussion was recorded on Zoom, so the sound quality will reflect that. So Johnny, your new project is on the video boom in 1980s Britain. Now, you've written about horror in this period before and the importance of VHS to the development of the genre. So why have you decided to broaden out the study away from horror?
It all goes back really to when I was doing my PhD. So my PhD was on British horror cinema in the 21st century, which I subsequently developed into the monograph Contemporary British Horror Cinema for Edinburgh University Press. And one of the chapters in that book is looking at the influence of the 1980s as a period where video exploded, the influence of that period on contemporary filmmakers. And you'll know that in the 1980s, famously, a number of horror videos were banned in Britain. There was the Video Nasties Panic, and there was new legislation brought in to regulate the video business, spurred on primarily from disgruntlement with the video trade that was frequently being framed as being irresponsible and, you know, peddling filth to kids and all the other nonsense that you heard in that period. But of course, a lot of the filmmakers working in Britain in the early to mid 2000s grew up during that period. So their first experiences of horror film was via the medium of VHS, and specifically Video Nasties, or at least films that were in some way associated with the Video Nasties Panic. So that was my entry, if you like, into investigating this period from a scholarly perspective. So in contemporary British horror cinema, I look at how those films influenced contemporary British filmmakers, and that inevitably meant me being exposed to materials on that era that I just hadn't been exposed to prior to this. I mean, I grew up in the 90s, and I learned about the Video Nasties through magazines such as the Dark Side magazine and a book that was published in, I think, 1998 called Video Nasties, which was written by Alan Bryce, the editor of the magazine. And I just remember seeing an advert for this book and being amazed that I hadn't heard of any of these films before. And bearing in mind that I was born in 87, and even when I was like 12, 13, I like to think that I had a good knowledge of the horror film, right? Because I lived and breathed it. And I was an avid collector. So I'd go to car boot sales and whatnot and buy random VHS cassettes and all the rest of it. But the Video Nasties, I just didn't have any knowledge of at all. And when I was doing my PhD, my knowledge of that period was really restricted to the information that was contained in those fan publications, right? Like Video Nasties. And it struck me, well, firstly, there hadn't been any real work done on the video business aside from the Video Nasties. But even in the scholarly work by, you know, the likes of Julian Petley, for instance, and Kate Egan, the emphasis wasn't on the business so much, but on the moral panic surrounding, you know, the specific Video Nasties themselves and their afterlives in popular culture, whether that be in fan communities or whether that be in the legal sense, in the the impact that the banning of the video cassettes had on British legislation, for instance. So yeah, so there was a gap, and the more I read, so I was very fortunate to do my PhD at De Montfort University, where there was a real methodological emphasis on primary archival research. And my main supervisor, Steve Chibnall, presides over several archives And he had a stack of video trade magazines from the 1980s, a publication called Video Business, which, you know, similar to Variety in the US and Screen International in the UK, was the video trade periodical that those working in the business would subscribe to. So it contains all the information about, you know, forthcoming releases, information about shops, where to get videos, you know, trends and all the rest of it. And it just became apparent that whereas the majority of the work that's been done on this period focuses on the video nasties, that really mischaracterizes the richness of that period. You know, one of the common myths about the period is that it was awash with independent video distributors who were opportunistic and out to make money at all costs, whether that meant corrupting children in the process or supplying children with, you know, violent or sexually explicit material. And the more research you do, you just realize that actually that is not a fair representation of what was happening in the period. And in fact, it was a business like any other business, you know, whereby popular, like horror was popular and sex films were popular. They were just one piece of a much broader and frankly banal picture of family entertainment, as it were. So the appeal, so the inroad to me was the video nasties and the impact of the video nasties on filmmakers. But what sort of got my juices flowing, as it were, was, you know, an opportunity, was approaching this opportunity to complicate a mythology that had grown around the video business as being one that was anchored solely to the video nasties and nothing else.
I think that's really interesting. I think for a start, you know, by the time I was going to the video shops, which would have been around the time that you were born, the video, obviously video nasties thing had blown out and you couldn't get those films anyway, right? So like, I mean, maybe people who got the boom early on, they were getting those cassettes early on, people who were a bit older. But if you weren't that, then you didn't have access to these films anyway. So it's like, yeah, like the video nasty history, it's important culturally, it's important aesthetically, I think, for the way it's influenced filmmakers. And indeed, arguably, its business is booming now, or at least in the last 10 years, since they've all been re-released on Blu-ray and DVD, right? Whereas by the time it was 1987 came around, I mean, as you say, it was really quite banal releases that are getting that are clogging up the video shops.
Yeah, I mean, you raise another question. Like, there is also a myth that when the Video Recordings Act came to be, that it was wholly rejected by the independent trade because it would cripple their business. And there's an argument that's been made numerous times that the Video Recordings Act signaled the end of this booming, flourishing network of independent distributors. You know, so you've got the pre-cert era, as it were, and then the post-cert era after the Video Recordings Act came into play in the mid 1980s. But that, for me, it just doesn't wash, because it's not accurate at all. So whereby, you know, in 1978, 1979, 1980, the market was awash with independent distributors. By the time that the majors came onto the market in 1980, and I'm talking like Fox, for instance, through its Magnetic label, Warner Home Video, CIC, you know, the big players, as it were, in theatrical distribution. By the time they came onto the business in the 1980s, you know, they were the most popular because they had the most desirable films. So as soon as the majors entered, the writing was on the wall for the independents, in terms of them struggling to sustain their business using the business model that they had adopted in 1978, say. So that's not to say that there weren't multiple independent companies, but in terms of the Video Recordings Act signaling their demise, it's not true. It's just not true. I mean, a lot of independent distributors went out of business in late 1982, before the Video Recordings Act was even a thing, because the market was saturated. They couldn't keep up with demand. There were too many films on the market. It was overcrowded. And with any business, as with any business, there's a rationalization period where the fat is trimmed. And if you're not dealing in films like Jaws and Raiders of the Lost Ark and The Sound of Music and Enter the Dragon, your product is always going to your product will not be as attractive to consumers or retailers because it doesn't have that air of quality per se. And that's also, I mean, that's not to say that independent companies weren't striving for quality. And it's also not the case that independents were just releasing really trashy B movies or anything like that. But it's just business logic that if you've got Raiders of the Lost Ark on video, which CIC did, that is always going to sell more than a film which is not Raiders of the Lost Ark, if you see what I'm saying. So the independents, like a lot of the independents had gone bust prior to the VRA, but even then, there were still independents active in the business. And more than that, the majority of independents welcomed the Video Recordings Act because they wanted the business to be regulated because they were sick of being raided willy-nilly by the police. So the argument that the VRA was, I mean, it was criticized, don't get me wrong. It was criticized by the business because it certainly wasn't perfect. And a lot of the arguments made about the failings of the VRA are absolutely 100% accurate. But to say that it was the product of a conspiracy theory between the major labels and the government and the British Video Association to crush independent companies isn't true, because independent companies continue to flourish, albeit in different areas into the mid, into the late 1980s. So I wanted to sort of like redress the balance really and add some flesh to the bones of what, up until this point at least, is a rather skeletal history of the video business in Britain.
So do you get a sense of, and forgive me if this is a difficult question, I'm not expecting a precise answer. So do you get a sense of how many companies that there were, how many independent companies were operating the market, let's say from the late 1970s to the coming of the Video Recordings Act?
The Video Recordings Act came into play in 84, and then companies had until 1986 to submit their works for certification. And this is another myth. So because because companies would have to submit their video releases to the British Board of Film Censors, as it was, and pay for the privilege of certification, people have argued in the past that, me included, actually, I've argued this in print in contemporary British horror cinema, that distributors just couldn't afford to have their films recertified. But that is nonsense too, because there wasn't really, well, there was a sense that back catalogue titles weren't renting anyway. So it wasn't even worth distributors' time recertifying their back catalogue. Most companies were focusing on new releases. Now, there was a growing budget market for back catalogue material, but in terms of the main distributors, whether they be majors or indies, it was the focus was on the new product all the time. So the notion that, I don't know, like a company that went bust, like Mountain Video was an independent company that went bust, right? But they didn't go bust because they couldn't afford to have their back catalog recertified. They went bust because their titles just weren't as appealing to the British consumer or the dealer. And, you know, people had warehouses, you know, there was just things beyond their control, you know, warehouses caught on fire. There was a leak, stock was ruined. They couldn't recoup the costs, you know, all of these sort of banal explanations for why businesses go out of business explain a lot of the companies going out of business in the 1980s. In 1978, which is when the video market began in earnest in Britain, there was like one or two distributors, okay? The most significant one is a company called Intervision, which went on to become associated with the Video Nasties Panic, actually, because it released the films The Cannibal Man and Expose. And actually, the Intervision name is now a DVD label in the States distributing micro-budget, trashy horror films. But that is such a misrepresentation of what Intervision was. I don't know if you remember the video chain Ritz Video.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Ritz was Intervision. So Intervision became a company called Cityvision in the 80s, which established the Ritz video chain, which of course sold to Blockbuster in the early 90s and thus made Blockbuster what it was in the 90s. So the image of Intervision as a distributor of trashy horror films is you know, in my view, hugely inaccurate. But anyway, so Intervision in 1978, and then through 1979, you get a couple more. VCL was one. Eyestead was another one. Michael J. Barrett was another one. But these largely were companies that were trading in video, were trading in music video cassettes or non-fiction, like Eyestead, for instance, had access to the NASA archives. So that's what they were putting out. Michael J. Barrett was putting out sort of manual style videos, how to do your garden, cooking, and all this stuff. But it was only Intervision really in the beginning that was specializing in feature films, which gave, go on, sorry.
What kind of films were Intervision releasing around 1978?
Intervision were releasing primarily lower budget independent productions that they'd acquired the rights for through Soho film distributors. But they also had art films. So it was a real broad church. They had some softcore porn stuff, but they had, you know, relatively major films. So in terms of Intervision and what they were releasing, I mean, just looking at their 1979 catalogue now, they've got comedy films, action adventure films, westerns, Hollywood classics, adult films, family entertainment. They've got a horror section. They've got a rock rhythm and blues section. They've got a fishing series. They've got a chess series. But in terms of the feature films, I mean, these were... They had an Eric Rohmer films, Love in the Afternoon. They've got Francois Truffaut's A Gorgeous Bird, Like Me. And the list goes on. So these aren't... And they've got a series of westerns they paid with bullets. The Car That Ate Paris they've got. So, I mean, they are... You know, you could hardly say that they were major mainstream releases. But in terms of the video business in 1978, 79... I mean, Intervision was a trailblazer because it was the only company that was even experimenting with this stuff, right? At least initially. And their offering was they had a broad church of releases that so broad, in fact, that it doesn't quite fit with what people now understand is a video nasty distributor, right?
Absolutely. So, you would not consider... you don't generally associate Eric Rohmer with the VHS boom, right?
Of course, well, no, absolutely. You know, Truffaut in the Video Nasty era.
Yeah.
You know, so this is the video business in 1979, and Intervision maintained that lead into the 1980s. It struck a deal with United Artists. You know, it was releasing a series, I think about 20 United Artists titles, the Pink Panther, Rocky, and some others. But then by the time you get to 81, 82, more people get in on the act, you get the majors coming in. And then by the time you get to like the summer of 82, there are 80 or so distributors distributing video films and other things, you know, other forms of video entertainment, like video magazines and stuff. So you've got 80 distributors, you've got numerous wholesalers as well, but you've also got 10,000 outlets in Britain renting this stuff.
Yeah.
So it's chaos, really, from a business perspective, because, okay, you've got 10,000 outlets, which indicates that there's a demand for this stuff, but you've got 80 distributors. Well, how many videos per month are these distributors releasing? 12? 20? You know, there's not the capacity. People cannot see all these films, right? And whereas it was hugely popular in Britain, was one of the first territories in the world that really embraced video. It was popular, but it was just the market was too crowded. People were gravitating towards feature films in a way that just was not anticipated. So if you go back to 78, 79, Intervision's the only one trading in feature films. That's because the other companies assumed that, well, if people can go to the cinema, they'll just go to the cinema and watch their film once. They won't need to watch it multiple times. Whereas they might want to watch an instructional garden video multiple times because it has this practical function. But of course, those, even though there was a market for that stuff, like companies like Michael J. Barrett, who specialized in that stuff, just really underestimated the boom for feature films that was in the midst of the distributors, really.
It seems to me there's like a, almost, maybe I'm stretching this too far, but there's almost a parallel with how a feature film's developed in the first place. I mean, it could have taken all sorts of multiple different forms early cinema. It could have been a form of documentary. It could have been a primarily a form of experimentation, or even a way of documenting events as a way of keeping a public record. And, you know, feature films being the primary way that we understand cinema is just one of the, well, the fact that we call it a cinema, and it, you know, it developed into 90 minutes and feature length stuff is just one of the ways it could have gone. But people forget often in those early days how it could have gone in multiple different directions. And to, that's interesting to find that VHS could have been, it could have purely have been instructional videos or National Geographic videos. I think they released those type of things as well. And, you know, a completely new form that we don't understand, and how feature films took over is an interesting way, especially since that was by no means a given in the late 1970s.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one thing which is true though, is that Britons did like staying in the house and watching television, right? Going to the cinema was a pastime and people were doing it. It was falling, however. I mean, you know, we're at the start of a recession here. People were spending more time in the house and they wanted to be entertained. Famously, in 79, ITV went on strike for a period of months. So that was one of the channels gone. And Intervision cite that period as being the moment where the membership to their clubs that they were running. So Intervision was a mail order firm at first. It had one shop. So this is before video clubs, as it were, video shops, as we came to know them. And they were renting from this one store in London, but primarily their business was mail order, and they would advertise in like the Evening Standard or whatever. So Intervision cite the ITV strike as being a moment which they capitalized on, because all of a sudden people were missing Coronation Street and they needed, in air quotes, some other form of entertainment. So who knows, right? If the ITV strike didn't happen, maybe video would have boomed a little bit later. I mean, I'm pretty confident that it would have boomed as it did everywhere. But, you know, that 3 month period or however long it was when the ITV network was down was a godsend to the first distributor. I mean, like I say, I think video would have boomed anyway. But in the US, I mean, video was booming in the US in 76, right? Like Fox had released a series of video cassettes in 76, which they then would subsequently go on to release in Britain in like late 79 or early 1980. So I think in terms of, you know, if we were to consider some of the reasons why video boomed when it did in Britain, it was people were less inclined to go outside to spend money because they didn't have as much money. But the money that they did have, they believed was worth investing in technology that would entertain them when they were at home. And also you've got to remember, and I'm sort of piggybacking on an article that Julian Upton wrote for the Journal of British Cinema and Television when I say this next point, British people were used to renting consumer electronics. You know, televisions. And, you know, companies like Radio Rentals and Granada and all these other multi-broadcast, these other companies, high street consumer electronics companies, you know, were well-schooled in marketing rentable hardware to the British public. And the VCR was really no different because it was made affordable. You know, and people, one of the questions that people ask me is, you know, why was video so popular among the working classes? You know, people who had been laid off. Well, people would take severance money or whatever savings they had And I'm being reductive here, of course, and it's way more nuanced than this. But, you know, renting a VCR was deemed a worthy means of spending one's money, especially when people were unemployed for so long. And I've got a great article that appears in Video Business, which is about the Northeast. And one video retailer, his video shop, he's quoted as saying that in Newcastle, video is a means for those out of work to kill the boredom. And whereas that's a flippant comment, it rings true of the climate. But but also, I think, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but like I think the history that we're talking about here is one that is very Western and very white. I mean, the communities that rarely get talked about, at least in the context of the video nasties side of things, are South Asian immigrants and their families. Now, South Asians were huge adopters of VHS and Betamax in the early 1980s. Huge adopters, because the Bollywood cinemas, Indian cinemas, were closing down, because video had just, and this is true in sort of mainland India and, you know, the Indian subcontinent as well. The VCR was booming over there as well, and because women were staying at home while their husband worked, or they might be looking after the children, video became very popular with stay-at-home women who weren't working. And the South Asian community really embraced video. And, that community plays a very key role in the video boom in the UK, but it's an invisible one, really. If you were to look at the history books, right? I mean, don't get me wrong. There are people writing about the South Asian video experience, like, you know, Rajinder Dudra being one of them. But, you know, that is very much in the field of media and cultural studies, whereas the video nasties side of things has been, in recent years at least, anchored more to film studies, as it were. And that was my inroad to it. But there are just aspects of this history which just do not get talked about in any meaningful way.
I think that's great. I think that experience of the women staying at home as well. Again, that was that does correlate a little bit. Again, maybe I'm reaching to the audiences of early cinema, right? Where early silent cinema very often popular with women because they weren't working and they were going to the pictures in the daytime. Again, that kind of the female audience here, you know, is often forgotten, and it's a really interesting and rich area. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
Maybe I'm wrong on this, but how significant is the family business to this idea of VHS and the video boom culturally? Because a lot of these places, the outlets were the local corner shop that would sell a few videos. The local petrol garage would have one of those carousel things with about 20 cassettes on it. And I wonder whether there's something about the VHS and Betamax and bringing movies into people's homes that made people, it kind of domesticated film fandom, right? It brought everyone becomes like a film fan or a film aficionado now, and it reaches a wider audience and it becomes something that the family talk about. And maybe this always happened in cinemas and maybe it always happened in pubs, but you have like a shared experience that's happening in a domestic space. And I wonder whether there's an element of the fact that you knew the video retailer. It wasn't necessarily somebody. My local video was a place called Palm Video, and the guy was Mr. Palm, and he was, you know, it's like a family business. That's what,
yeah.
You know the person who's renting the stuff and he stands behind the counter, you know. And can you say something about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the history of which you speak is a romantic one. And it sort of chimes with Quentin Tarantino's, the stories he tells about working in a video shop and you became an expert and you were guiding consumers. And it also chimes with a narrative that's been written by Joshua Greenberg in the States. So essentially, the book that Greenberg wrote a few years ago, I'm essentially doing the British version of that. But in that book, he really talks about this romantic narrative of mom and pop shops. And he alludes to sort of the familial element that you talk about. But I mean, speaking about the British side of things, firstly, if we go back to the South Asian community, video, certainly in that context, video was anchored to family businesses. So whether or not they were shops that were established as video shops in the first instance, or whether or not video was brought in to complement what existing corner shops, say, were selling, these certainly were family-run businesses where families would, a lot of the time, live above the shop, right? And there's a great example of in Leicester, for instance, which of course is densely ethnically populated, and certainly at least in the 90s and in the 80s had the biggest Indian population outside of Bombay. I think it was I could be wrong about that, but it was certainly outside of India, the city where the most Indians resided. And of course, in areas like Narborough Road, the west end of Leicester, where immigrant communities would tend to cluster, there were, of course, businesses that were catering to those communities, whether they be selling, for example, saris, for instance, or, other culturally specific items that to a Western consumer may feel alien. And there's a great example of a shop that was called Dave Pan and Sweet Center, which is an Indian confectioner's that would sell Indian sweets, but it would also sell pans or a kind of herbal chewing tobacco that would be outlawed eventually. But this shop was set up, I think, in 75, because the family who owned it had been expelled from Uganda because Idi Amin, the prime minister, there was this famous Asian expulsion in 1972. So the family, who were wealthy, they had a customs business. They had money in their home country, invested that capital into this shop, this Indian sweet shop. And when video boomed, they just brought video into that business, and you had all the family members running the shop. So in that context, and they were renting Bollywood films as well. Now, I don't want to speak about this shop in particular, but among the South Asian video dealers, piracy was rife. Bollywood films were imported informally. Also formally by legitimate companies like Esquire. But these shops were providing immigrants and the family members of these immigrants a taste of home, as it were. There were no Indian cinemas anymore, or very few. So in terms of video providing this sense of centrality to the household in the way that the television always has done, it enabled South Asian families, either first generation immigrants to experience their home life again in a way, but also to educate their children as to what popular entertainment was like in on the Indian subcontinent, as it were.
I think there's an interesting thing. I mean, the Palm video, he was run by a South Asian man, Indian man, but he's it's obviously from Wolverhampton, so it's a fairly mixed area, and there mm-hmm. it's fairly mixed anyway. But he was the estate that he was on, as far as I could tell, was predominantly white. So you also had this idea where there's, but he's the local kind of video man. So it does, I think there was an element, obviously we're being reductive when we use, especially when we're using single examples to stand in for the whole, right? But there's also an element there where there's the there is a community focus in something like an estate, and it's got one video shop, and he just did videos. He did have a Bollywood section, and he did live above the shop.
Well, I mean, you point to a very interesting truism when you talk about the video shop on the estate. You know, one of the reasons that the major electronics retailers really failed to grasp video in the early 1980s was precisely because they were located on the high street in urban centers and didn't really focus on suburbia or more rural areas. So when we're talking about the 10,000 video retailers that were operating in 1982, some of them were certainly in the city center, but they were reaching far beyond that. And this is again a key example of individuals taking a risk on a new technology, where the high street multiples, as it were a little bit more trepidatious, as it were. And they weren't extending their reach beyond the center of town. So that's when, I mean, you're right. That's when video takes on this domestic sense, whereby it's part of the estate, in the same way that the corner shop is, or the local supermarket is. It's providing the community with a service.
Yeah, and also we can sometimes, the word domestic can stand in for something that's homely, but I don't necessarily mean it in that respect, right? Something could be domestic, can also be, you know, something where, you know, I had this thing where we'd have one video recorder, and when I wanted to watch what I wanted to watch, you know, I would unplug it from the TV, right, and take it upstairs and watch it on a little portal, and then have to take it downstairs again. Right?
Have you got any back problems?
Well, yeah, and it's like, so, you know, there was still an element where, you know, you would have entertainment that was geared toward particular members of the household. I don't remember many times when we as a family watched a video all at the same time, right?
You're speaking to the broadness of the video business. You know, it's not just a slew of filth, is it? I mean, these are companies who are catering to quote unquote everyone, and there is, you know, degrees of experimentation. I mentioned the gardening instruction videos and all the rest of it. You know, music, weird interactive videos that just didn't take off. 3D videos. You know, all this random stuff. But primarily, the main driver of the video business was not softcore pornography. I mean, that was hugely popular, as it remains, right? But it was, quote unquote, variety, family entertainment, making sure that all members of the household were catered for in some capacity. And this is when the beginning of the video sales market begins. It's not because all of a sudden there's this huge demand for illicit black market filth, which is the sort of the characteristic, the caricature, if you like, of the period. It's because parents were, you know, wanted to provide their children with entertainment in the house during the school holidays. So children's videos were selling at a pretty good rate as early as 1982, way before three or four years before the sell-through market, as it were, took off, you know, before you could buy your $9.99 videos in Woolworths and stuff. It was the family. You know, and there's this famous stereotype of the video cassette being the electronic babysitter. You know, you mentioned the terrible British weather. Like, you know, if you've got kids off school in the Easter holidays and the weather's terrible, but all of a sudden you've got this bumper 3-hour cartoon video that's available to rent or to purchase. And I mean, they're expensive to purchase. You're probably talking about 20 quid to buy the children's video. But even that was like half the price of what other feature films were being sold for, right? So if you want to buy a feature film, 38, 40, 45 quid, for like a copy of, I don't know, The Exorcist or whatever Warner home video title you may have been interested in. But distributors saw that there was this gap in the market to exploit, the children's market. And it wasn't feeding them video nasties either. It was providing them with anodyne, banal, public domain cartoons. you know, Superman, for instance, the famous Superman cartoons from the 30s, serials with Bela Lugosi, you know, like stuff like this. The children's market was booming in that period, which, if anything, really complicates that history that it was this seedy environment, you know, where people were, you know, peddling smut to children. It's like, well, there probably is some truth to that, like people being able to rent from, you know, the discreetly rent material from the video shop. But like in terms of the way the business was going, there was like an effort made to target the children's market with stuff that children would want to watch.
I think I'm sympathetic in a way to the idea of the video, the video period as being, as you say, the slew of filth and the sense of the illicit, only because I think it says something about what culture is like today. It's absolutely a romantic notion and it's a very selective idea of what the history was. But I think it tells us something about today. Is there an element of this kind of nostalgia for this period that tells us something about the cleanliness of today's kind of the images, HD images, 4K images, 4K Ultra, Blu-rays, all this type of stuff, the kind of cleanliness of it. Everything's kind of like, and the antiseptiveness of entertainment today, particularly cinematic and film entertainment, as opposed to in the past when there was far less official film fandom. People were discovering avenues for themselves. You know, even if, like you say, people weren't renting a really obscure films necessarily, even if they were renting an Eric Rohmer film, or they were renting a film that was, you know, that we now understand as a classic or as part of the canon, people wouldn't have been necessarily told that it was a classic or part of the canon, right, before they rented it, particularly if they were renting it when they were quite young, right?
Yeah.
The same media studies education, film studies education, and things like that. So I wonder whether this, you know, the nostalgia for these forms and for these, you know, and the way that it was illicit or dangerous or somehow more exciting than today's culture tells us something about how shit things are now. You know?
Maybe, but I mean, one thing that I would say is that, you know, the 80s was also the era of sight and sound, and it was, you know, monthly film bulletin, and there were plenty of cineast publications available that were sort of fostering a sense of what quality cinema means. Now, that's not to say that that would necessarily translate to sort of a 12 or 13 year old, but even you know, the boom in video consumer magazines, Video World, Video Today, Video the Magazine, Television and Home Video, Video Review, Continental Film and Video. These magazines in various ways helped shape, and you know, in a way that Pierre Bourdieu would have a field day with, would try to shape a sense of what tasteful video was, at least as the 1980s progressed. Like, and whereas it was, you know, relatively common for, like, I don't know, like a video magazine like Video Review to have its film of the month be a horror film, it wasn't always the case. You would get a classic. You would get film stars on the front. Harrison Ford would be on the cover of the magazine. Clint Eastwood would be on the cover of the magazine. There would be interviews with film stars. You know, Video Review, for instance, would do, you know, 4-page articles on Bollywood, for instance. You know, or European cinema. So even though video pales in comparison in terms of, well, even though the culture wasn't as sophisticated in terms of the HD restorations and the widescreen, I do think that even in the 80s, there was a concerted effort made by the industry press to create a sense of, you know, these are the good films that you should watch, and these are the bad films that you probably shouldn't waste your money on.
I think that's really, yeah, it's a really good point. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I think the 80s is it's a kind of burgeoning sense of, you know, yeah, film education maybe is coming in at that point. And you do get like, camcorder clubs and things like that. There's a sense of kind of filmmaking that's developing around that time. I suppose I can say when I was 12 and 13, yeah, I would say looking at the films came before seeking out Video World magazine, right? And film review.
Yeah.
Magazine. But you're right. There probably is a good crossover point at that.
But I wonder, like, you know, for 12 and 13 year olds today, I mean, it's a bit of a silly question because the culture is so different and moving image entertainment is so different. But I think a quote unquote appreciation of cinema or a knowledge of film history is something which grows. I mean, it certainly grew for me throughout my teens and my early 20s, you know, but I think that in terms of, I mean, the BFI embraced video in the 1980s as well. And, you know, into the 90s, we're releasing, you know, like the Bicycle Thieves and all this stuff. So I do think that even though, of course, it's not the same as it is now, and even though the 12 and 13-year-olds were being drawn to the films that they were being drawn to, not because they read, you know, a four-page piece in Sight and Sound magazine on Eisenstein or whatever, I do think that there was a genuine push among video and film journalists to create, to offer consumer advice and to communicate to cineasts or aspiring cineasts.
All I can say is that the BFI's influence never reached me because I was directing things like The Humanoid and Star Crash. And thank God I did, otherwise I wouldn't be into the things that I am now.
For sure. Oh, well, I mean,
I certainly wasn't renting Bicycle Thieves. Exactly. When did the boom tail off?
The boom was tailing off in the mid 80s, actually, because the market by this point had rationalized. A lot of the companies had gone bust. And there was a sense among the trade that the industry had peaked too soon. And it was certainly Intervision's opinion that errors had been made along the way, that they'd simply just released too many films at once, or rather too many films in too short a time. And that as a consequence, people were just becoming wise to the whole thing, consumers that is. You know, dealers weren't prepared to spend £40 to £50 on a B movie anymore. Video companies, however, were being charged extortionate rates for the rights to release films, whether they were B movies or not. And consumers weren't prepared to rent that kind of stuff anymore. So something had to change in the market. Prices had to come down for a start. And that's what you start to see. So in 1985, you get the early stirrings of sell-through video through the launch of the video collection in Woolworths, where videos were under a tenner, $9.99. And they were, you know, strangely, it was a bit like the early rental business in like 78, 79, where you have these, you know, Westerns from the 50s and 60s being released onto sell through VHS and, you know, classics, as it were, being sold for a cheap price. Children's entertainment as well being sold for a relatively cheap price. But also you had major companies who were, up until this point, offering films largely as rental only, reassessing their business model, bringing prices down, and say, for example, trade pricing their films at £20 or £15 or £12, so that the video dealer could make the decision in terms of whether or not they wanted to rent it out or whether or not they wanted to sell it for like 20, 25 quid, which at the time was deemed to be cheap. Good weather, a couple of years of good weather in the summer meant that people weren't watching as many videos anymore. But then by the time we get to the 1980s, we're entering the era of Ritz Video now and the national video chain era. And there was many. Ritz was one of them. There were a few others. Blockbuster, famously, launched in 1989. But, I mean, Ritz had had a couple of years under its belt by this point. I think Ritz had established maybe in 86 or 87, something like that. And they were helping the industry brush up its image. Because whereas I said at the beginning of this chat that the Video Nasties era dominates discussion, it is certainly true that if the Video Nasties situation didn't necessarily impact the distributors, it certainly impacted the retail sector, because it was always the video shops that were being tarnished in the press reports as being, you know, Kate Egan's got a great quote in her book Trash or Treasure, where she quotes a journalist referring to them as filth merchants. So the trade was hit hard, this negative image of the seedy backstreet video store. And Ritz and, some other stores sought to re-energize and clean up the image of the video retail sector, as it were. And then by the time you get Blockbuster in 1989, and then Blockbuster buys Ritz in the early 90s, you also around about the same time get, because the independents were so negatively, were written about so negatively, the company Parkfield, which was a major, which was a corporation, it released music, it released videos in the mid to late 1980s, established a symbol group called Hollywood Nights, which you may remember, which was established as a means of saving the independent retail sector. So basically, independents could opt to be part of the Hollywood Nights scheme. They would get new branding, the Hollywood Nights branding. They would get new stock. They would be kitted out to basically help them survive this, you know, rather bleak period for the trade. So there's all sorts of things happening to try and make video attractive again. And then Blockbuster sets up, buys Ritz, dominates, and, you know, changes the video business. And it becomes the video business that we experienced in the 90s and early 2000s, right? So the boom itself lasted probably 4 to 5 years as the gold rush, as it were. And it remained really, really popular video, and it did grow in popularity year on year. But it's really that 1979 to 1982 period that is the video boom, as it were. That's when it booms. And for the rest of the decade, it's the dust settling, if you like.
That was Dr. Johnny Walker talking about Britain and the video boom. I want to say thanks to Johnny for being a guest, and thanks to you for listening. News and Talks will return.